then again it would have had to be reported to members of Congress, and that they then placed the explosives on portions of the pipeline that they had identified as a particularly good place to disrupt it and sabotage it, and then they detonated it. That was immediately attacked by a lot of commentators online, a lot of other journalists, but interestingly, was never, and still to this moment, has never gotten a fair hearing in the New York Times or the Washington Post. In fact, last week when the New York Times published a story that, you know, reverberated around the world, asserting that U.S. intelligence believes that or is zeroing in on what they called a pro-Ukrainian group that may have been involved with attacking or sabotaging the Nord Stream pipeline, they for the first time mentioned Seymour Hersh's report. And it was in the 23rd graph of their story. And they didn't even make any assertion of what Tsai actually said. They were mentioning it as though Tsai had just done a blog post referencing Joe Biden's, you know, perceived public threat. And I think what was clear to me as a follower of both the New York Times and U.S. covert action is that there are elements within the U.S. intelligence community who are spinning this story. And they're doing it for one of two reasons, either to distract from Hersh's report or because this is representative of some sort of a deception operation or an attempt to put together a false flag where you have the appearance that these individuals did it and that is intended to mask the actual sponsor of the operation. And at the same time that the New York Times does its story, a consortium of German journalists from different publications, including Die Zeit, published a story that was not based on intelligence reporting, but was based on the federal criminal investigation that Germany is doing into the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. And they then offered more details from the German investigation that there was a private boat that had been rented from a Ukrainian-owned company, and that explosives had been transported by land over Poland and through Germany and placed onto this what essentially was just a kind of sailboat with a 75 horsepower motor, and that this boat carried six individuals, some divers and a doctor, and that they went out into the sea and that they were the ones that actually placed the explosives on it. Now, what's interesting, Amy, and you asked Tsai Hersh about this on his show, about some of the open source intelligence researchers who called into question parts of his story. Some of those same people then started to go to town in dissecting the inconsistencies of the reporting from Die Zeit and the findings as they were relayed in the papers in Germany from the German federal police about how such a small team of divers would have been able to do this, how they would have transported the volume of explosives. We're talking about hundreds upon hundreds of pounds of explosives that were alleged to have been used in this operation, a military level of explosive devices. So I don't know that this Andromeda, this ship, was or wasn't involved with it. But in many ways, it really reeks of a disinformation operation. It's totally plausible that these individuals on that boat were involved in some capacity. But even the German defense minister himself, in response to these reports, has said that he would give equal weight to the theory that they were involved with the attack and that they were, or that they were part of a false flag operation. Now, I would say the top suspect in this should just logically be the United States. Many of the same principles that I could offer in analyzing this private boat scenario could also apply to Russia. It's just that the case that Russia would have had the motive to do this is much flimsier than the case that the United States would have or that Ukraine would have. What I think is a theory that, you know, and again, this is just speculation on my part, but it's informed speculation, is that I wouldn't be shocked if we at some point learn that the United States sponsored this operation using deniable assets for plausible deniability, and that some elements of Ukrainian forces, whether they're private or official, were involved or if not carried out the operation. I think that would be the most logical line of inquiry. I'm not saying I know that to be true. I'm saying if I was running an investigation on this, I would be looking at who benefits and who has the capacity to do such a sophisticated operation.
Well, Jeremy, in line with that issue of the sophisticated operation, I don't know if you saw the piece that Scott Ritter the former UN weapons inspector wrote in Consortium News yesterday. But he totally debunks this idea that this small boat, as you say, could have been involved in this, not only because of the number, the amount of explosives necessary to destroy those pipelines, which were highly reinforced in concrete as well. But he also says that they were at 240 feet below the level of the water, and that he says a rule of thumb is that decompression takes approximately one day per 100 feet of seawater plus a day. This means that the team of divers would have required 3 days of decompression per dive. But to decompress, you need a decompression chamber. And if there were two divers involved, they would have to have had two decompression chambers and all the oxygen necessary. And it's impossible to have fit all that stuff on this little boat. So he says that it is clearly, from his perspective, a cover story to hide who really was involved. Wondering your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even need to cite Scott Ritter on those points. I mean, you've had naval warfare experts that have called into question almost every single part of that narrative. The narrative meaning that the actual divers were on this small ship and went down to place the explosives. I mean, if you speak to people who are experts at diving, either on the civilian end or more relevant on the military end, it really does not add up. And so then the question becomes, why is this story being pushed? You know, it's interesting. This hasn't gotten much play in the United States, but in European media, there's a lot of reporting indicating that a name is going to come out about the person who, you know, potentially sponsored this component of the operation. And I think that the fact that the German defense minister is stating that it's like 50-50 that this thing was a false flag is a pretty good indication that that dominant narrative that's been pushed, that this was sort of the attackers and they used this ship and they did it by themselves, it just doesn't pass the smell test. You don't even need to get into political rhetoric or having any other theory about it, just to say the facts just don't make any sense on a technical level that specific ship could have been, the sole party responsible for blowing this up.
Jeremy Scahill, we want to thank you for being with us, senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and the book Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, on which the Oscar-nominated film Dirty Wars is based. We'll link to your new piece, Conflicting Reports Thicken Nord Stream Bombing Plot. Coming up, we look at the fight to protect reproductive rights in the United States as a Trump-appointed judge in Texas is deciding whether to ban the abortion pill used by more than half the abortions in the United States. Stay with us.
I've been down with a broken heart since the day I learned to speak. The devil gave me a crooked sword when he gave me crooked feet. But Gabriel done came to me and kissed me in my sleep. And I'll be singing like an angel until I'm 6 feet deep. I found myself an omen and I tattooed on a sign. I set my mind a wandering and walk a broken line. And you have a mind to keep me quiet, and although you can try, better men have hit their knees and bigger men have died.
Praise Hell by Brandi Carlile. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to the fight to protect reproductive rights in the United States. A decision could come as early as today from a Trump-appointed federal judge in Texas on whether to ban the abortion pill mifepristone nationwide. The hearing is taking place in Amarillo, a four-hour drive from any major city, and only became public after reporters raised alarm about the lack of transparency after Judge Matthew Kaczmarek tried to delay notice and hide the date. The lawsuit aims to revoke the Food and Drug Administration's two-decade approval of the abortion pill and comes after the Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right to abortion last year, overturning Roe v. Wade. We go right now to Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation. Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now! So first, let's take on this hearing today. Trump-appointed anti-abortion judge is deciding whether this drug can be used. It's used in more than half the abortions in the United States. So if he decides no, even in states where abortion is totally legal, they will not have access. Is that right?
That's right, Amy. If the judge succeeds in revoking the FDA's approval of mifepristone, which has been on the market in the United States for 23 years, then it would have a catastrophic impact specifically in states where abortion is legal. I mean, we're talking about this hearing taking place in a state that's not even going to be impacted by it because abortion is already banned in Texas. And so this would reverberate across states like where I'm sitting in Massachusetts, New York, California, states where abortion is legal. The abortion pill mifepristone is the first of two drugs used in the standard of care for medication abortion. And so what providers across the country have been preparing to do in preparation for this ruling is to start providing misoprostol-only abortions, so medication abortion using only the second drug in the protocol. That still works, but it's less effective. It's about 88% effective, according to a recent study, versus up to 99% when it's used with mifepristone. And it causes more intense suffering, more cramping, more prolonged bleeding, and a more intensive process for the person going through that medication abortion. So we're talking about imposing suffering on medication abortion patients across the country. And as you point out, medication abortion using mifepristone is the most popular method of abortion used in more than half of abortions nationwide. So this could have a huge impact. Of course, it depends on exactly what the Food and Drug Administration does in response to this ruling. And there's a growing chorus of voices saying that the FDA should simply choose to ignore this ruling and that providers should continue to offer this drug where they can. So I think it's unclear exactly what the impact will be until we have a decision. But I think this really should put to bed any pretense that this was ever about states' rights or about returning abortion to the elected representatives in the states, which is what the Supreme Court claimed that it was doing with the Dobbs Supreme Court decision, right? In fact, what we're seeing is an effort to ban abortion nationwide using what anti-abortion legal strategists hope is a judicial pipeline that's going to allow them to go all the way up to the Supreme Court and have a sympathetic anti-abortion hearing.
And Amy, what are the legal arguments of those who have brought this case, especially given the fact that the FDA has a green-lighted the use of the drug for so long?
Exactly, Juan. I mean, what's remarkable about this case, right, is we wouldn't even be talking about it if it weren't for the judge who's involved, because the legal arguments here amount to that the FDA did not follow the protocol that it was supposed to when it approved the drug, when in fact mifepristone has been stringently studied. There's data from tens of thousands of patients who've taken it that demonstrate that serious complications happen less than a fraction of a percent of the time. And so the arguments in this case really add up to we don't like abortion and we don't think it should be available. It's being brought by the right-wing legal organization Alliance Defending Freedom, which is the legal group that brought you the fall of Roe v. Wade, on behalf of a bunch of anti-abortion medical organizations. The Justice Department, which is defending the FDA's approval of mifepristone, has called these claims in the lawsuit unfounded. They're not new. They're the same arguments they've been making since mifepristone was first approved. But the reason that we're even talking about this right now is because of Judge Matthew Kaczmarek. Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, who served on the board of a Christian anti-abortion maternity home where his sister gave birth as a teenager and put the baby up for adoption. Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, who's railed against everything from homosexuality, which he considers disordered, to no-fault divorce laws and the decision to get rid of penalties for adultery, which he sees as part of an effort to undermine heterosexual marriage. In a case that could be a harbinger for this one, Judge Matthew Kaczmarek in December upheld the right of a father who wanted to prevent his teen daughters from seeking contraception at federal clinics in Texas because he said that if his daughters were to access contraception, it would violate his religious beliefs. And in a decision that cited Catholic catechism, Judge Matthew Kaczmarek sided with the father in that case. And so I think, you know, he founded a chapter of the Federalist Society, the right-wing organization that helped Trump handpick Trump Supreme Court justices. He was a staff attorney at First Liberty Institute, which is a Christian right law firm. I could go on and on about Judge Matthew Kaczmarek's anti-abortion
credentials. Well, can you talk about what he did today, Amy? Having this hearing and trying to keep it secret?
I mean, this is remarkable, Amy. Judge Matthew Kaczmarek on Friday held a call with the attorneys in this case and said, look, we've been getting a lot of phone calls about this. We've even been getting some death threats. I don't want a circus-like atmosphere in my courtroom. And so please don't tell anyone about this hearing that we're scheduling for Wednesday. And he told the attorneys he was not going to put it on the public docket until late on Tuesday. Now, Eleanor Klebanoff, who's been covering this case for the Texas Tribune, said, look, if I found out late Tuesday about a hearing that was happening Wednesday morning, she would have had to drive through the night on Tuesday, right, to reach Amarillo, Texas, where this hearing is taking place from Austin, which is 8 hours away. So, I mean, I know because I'm seeing their posts that there are journalists camped out on the steps of that courthouse who have been there since the crack of dawn. Apparently, they're choosing to let in 19 journalists. But that's only after Judge Matthew Kaczmarek went to pretty unusual measures to try to prevent the public from knowing what was going to be going on in this hearing today, which obviously is of enormous public interest to people across the country.
Meanwhile, Amy, also in Texas, five women are suing after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risks to their health and were non-viable. You wrote a piece in The Nation recently, She Had a Heartbeat Too, Waiting for One Dead Woman. Tell us about the near-death experience of Amanda Zarosky.
Yeah. Juan, I was actually listening to Democracy Now! On Friday and listening to the clip of Amanda Zarosky that you played, where she talks about how she was losing her pregnancy, losing a very wanted pregnancy. Her water broke at about 18 weeks. The doctors in Texas told her, "We're so sorry. Your pregnancy is not going to survive, but we cannot terminate it because the fetus still has a heartbeat, and we are terrified of going to jail or facing civil penalties under Texas abortion law." And so she waited for days, and she needed to wait until either the fetus died or she became so close to the brink of death that doctors would feel justified in saving her. And when I was listening to her story, Amy and Juan, I had this feeling, this sad and angry feeling that I felt so many times before, because I know this story. Before Roe v. Wade even fell, I wrote about how women in Catholic hospitals had been subjected to a same days-long wait until they got so close to the brink of death that doctors felt that they could intervene and terminate the pregnancy, despite the Catholic ethical and religious directives that guide healthcare in 1 in 6 acute care beds nationwide in these Catholic hospitals. These stories, now that Roe v. Wade is gone, we are hearing these stories emerging with just crushing regularity. And I started to think about how with enough almost dead women, because that's the threshold, you can only get an abortion if you are almost dead, we are eventually going to have someone who dies. And I wrote this article for two reasons. One is that I wanted to really debunk the idea that these life and health exceptions and abortion bans mean anything, because what we see in Amanda Zarosky's case and the other women in this Texas lawsuit is that when you impose prison sentences and civil penalties on doctors, they are not going to intervene until the most extreme situations possible. When you close the abortion clinics in a state, you get rid of the infrastructure for people to even contemplate an abortion. And then the second reason is that I wanted to issue a warning that, you know, in Ireland, Savita Halappanavar died in 2012 in a situation very similar to Amanda Zarosky's, because when people get sick while miscarrying, they can decline very fast. And I am afraid that we are going to see someone die in this country. And I hope when that happens, that her death means something the way it did in Ireland, where Savita's death led to a transformation of Ireland's abortion laws.
Amy Littlefield, want to thank you so much for being with us. There's so much more to talk about, but we will do this, of course, in the days to come as well. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent at The Nation, former Democracy Now! Producer. We'll link to your piece just out. She had a heartbeat, too, waiting for one dead woman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As news of Americans kidnapped in Mexico and two of them killed is making headlines, we look at a story that's received less attention, the tens of thousands of Mexicans who remain missing in Mexico. Last week, four Americans who traveled to Matamoros, Mexico for plastic surgery were caught in a shootout between drug cartels, with two killed, two others held captive for days before they were rescued. One was shot repeatedly. Three women from a Texas border town have been missing since February after traveling to a flea market in Matamoros. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Mexicans remain missing in cases that have gone unsolved, some of them for decades. This includes the 2014 case we have followed closely for years of the 43 young men from Ayotzinapa Teachers College who were attacked and forcibly disappeared. We go now to Kate Doyle. She is senior analyst at the National Security Archives, who has new details about what happened that are drawn from the Ayotzinapa records and the 4 million emails and records stolen from the Mexican Defense Ministry by an anonymous collective of hackers known as Guacamaya. They just released a new report, and she also co-produced the After Ayotzinapa podcast with Reveal as part of the NSA's ongoing work on this case. Thanks so much for rejoining us, Kate. You're joining us actually from Guatemala City. Can you talk about what you found and talk about this in the context of when Americans pay attention and when they don't?
Sure, Amy. Thanks. And good morning to both you and Juan. The Guacamaya leaks document set from the Mexican military has records as far as we've seen so far. We've really just only begun to look at them, that go back as early as 2006 to show the level of hostility towards and surveillance of the Ayotzinapa school, where the 43 students who were disappeared in 2014 attended. In the context of the case of the Americans who were killed and the others who were missing, And the over 100,000 Mexicans who are missing and disappeared, as you mentioned at the top, the Ayotzinapa case is a kind of paradigmatic example, if you will, or stands in, if you will, for all of the thousands of missing Mexicans, in that it shows the tremendous impunity that still dominates these cases of disappeared, which are not solved. The people are not found and nobody is punished. So the Guacamaya leaks documents really confirm suspicions that people had about the Mexican military's efforts to both cover up what happened, shield itself from any kind of public scrutiny about its own role in Iguala the night the boys were disappeared, the town in Guerrero where they went missing, and to conduct surveillance and spy on the school, the students, their parents, and the human rights organizations that represent them legally, going back, you know, almost a decade. And I can talk about specific documents, but overall, that's the kind of things that we're finding.
Yeah, Kate, could you talk specifically in terms of how they were sought to discredit the parents and the lawyers and even the UN commission after the disappearances?
sure, Juan. I mean, when you look back at 2006, this intelligence report that we found that shows the intensity of the scrutiny that the military was doing on the school itself, the spying, clearly the school was infiltrated. And they used a kind of language of counterinsurgency to describe the students and the school, calling it a breeding ground for subversion. Then you look at more recent documents, one, for example, in another intelligence report from as recent as 2020, that discusses criminal activities in Iguala, this same town, and compares them and conflates them, really, with the social movements that have been started by the parents and the organizations that support them. In this particular document I'm thinking of, you see kind of parallel strategies in the way the military talks about organized criminal leaders and leaders in the parents' movement to demand answers for the disappearance of their own sons who were taken away by police officials in police uniforms in the backs of police trucks and never seen again. So it's kind of an extraordinary example of the sort of elision between the way the military views criminals as a kind of conflictive element in Mexico and the way the military views social activists and leaders and parents of missing boys. And it's a really disturbing tell on how the defense ministry considers these parents.
I want to play a clip of Mexico's former defense secretary, Salvador Cienfuegos Zepeda. In a 2015 interview, he responded to accusations the Mexican military was involved in the disappearance of the 43 students in Ayotzinapa.
I can't permit my soldiers to be treated like criminals or to be interrogated so that they are later made to feel that they had something to do with the night of Iguala instead of being supported.
Kate Doyle, can you respond?
Sure. That's so of a piece with how the military has tried to shield itself really from the beginning of this case from any kind of investigative body, any kind of scrutiny. Cienfuegos, then defense minister, refused to allow investigators to interview anybody in the defense institution, including the soldiers who make up what's known as the 27th Military and Infantry Battalion, which has its base in Iguala. And the same soldiers were moving around Iguala the entire night while these students were being shot at with machine guns, while these students were being beaten. Some of them were wounded, some of them were killed, and then 43 of them were taken away in the backs of the trucks. Soldiers never intervened to stop that. And Salvador Cienfuegos, the defense minister, never permitted the investigators to interview them. There were other ways in which, Amy, the military sought to shield itself. For example, one of the documents that is in this collection that we posted from Guacamaya shows that when the parents and their lawyers suggested that they should be able to enter the base, the 27th Battalion's base in Iguala, to see if there's any evidence there, to possibly conduct excavations or exhumations to see if they could find remains, there are internal memos to the same defense secretary, Cienfuegos, recommending that any detention cells that may be on the base be dismantled and removed, and that soldiers or the commander of the base explicitly refuse to allow the investigators to excavate or dig up the ground of the base.
Well, we want to thank you, Kate Doyle, for being with us, a senior analyst at the National Security Archive. We're going to link to your report at democracynow.org. Kate was speaking to us, actually, from Guatemala City in Guatemala. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Jarena Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Sanjit Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Rocky Graham, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Make sure to tune tune into our segments through the week leading up to the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Bonne fête, rendez-vous. On est déjà en mars, ce qui veut dire que les célébrations entourant le 25e anniversaire des Rendez-vous de la francophonie sont en cours. Dès maintenant, visitez le rvf.ca pour voir ce que les rendez-vous vous ont préparé.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases. From any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.